On November 14th, Mr. Kurusu arrived in San Francisco, smiling his toothy smile as he sang the old song of Japanese friendship.
The Japanese were a peace-loving people. Their whole policy was devoted to the establishment of permanent peace in Asia. Our aid to China was delayed.
Foreign diplomacy is similar to sketching on the sand. Regardless of the treaties concluded and amity established, they are completely wiped away should the big wave of clash of national interests wash ashore. In extreme cases, doesn't the fruit of the efforts of a predecessor end in complete failure because of the doing of his successors? Those were the words of my son, who was killed in the last war, when he decided on a career in engineering instead of continuing my works. Now, when I look back on my long diplomatic life, these words reappear in my mind. I was about to begin writing of my various observations and experiences gained at my numerous posts. These were all priceless experiences, but they, in the final analysis, were merely writings sketched in the sand. I ended my diplomatic life with the failure of the important mission to conclude Japanese-American negotiations in late 1941. My 35 years in diplomacy, after all, were merely a bubble. It is useless to try to piece together the pieces of broken earthenware, but I wonder whether it isn't a basic human trait to try anyway. It is being said that it is hardly possible, after all, for an envoy who had been hurriedly flown with such an important responsibility at such a critical time just prior to the outbreak of war, not to have an accurate knowledge of what would follow in the event of his mission's failure. This deduction is indeed reasonable as a conclusion reached within a country having a normal political structure and under normal conditions. But no matter how I may try to deny it, it is exceedingly difficult for me to convince others. It was midnight of the 3rd of November 1941. I was fast asleep from the fatigue of having walked at the exhibition of Ueno with my son during the day, when I was rudely awakened by the visit of a policeman from the Kojimachi station. As our phone was out of order, he had come as an urgent messenger of the foreign minister to relay the message that I was wanted immediately at the residence of the foreign minister. On hurrying to his residence, I found Foreign Minister Shigenori Togo, Vice Minister Haruhiko Nishi, Kumaichi Yamamoto of the American Bureau, and Toshikazu Kase of the First Section American Bureau, all with a tense look standing in the large drawing room on the second floor. It appeared as though they had just concluded an important conference. On that occasion, the foreign minister first explained, in general terms, the state of the Japanese-American negotiation, and then requested me to go to America, at this time as a special envoy, and do my utmost in helping Ambassador Kichisaburo Nomura to conclude the negotiation. Now, according to his explanation as foreign minister, America's attitude in the negotiation had continued to be unyielding, with no signs of any conciliatory attitude. Furthermore, since America's economic pressure is becoming increasingly great, our country has been placed in a predicament wherein she must devise some drastic measure to break the deadlock. Since the deployment of our military strength, provided for an emergency, would become known sooner rather than later, and if that should happen, the Japanese-American negotiation would inevitably become much more difficult, it must be said that the situation, from an objective state, was already in a dangerous state. It is needless to say that since the mission was of such great importance, I thought that they should have selected the most qualified from among the numerous experienced elder statesmen. But the situation, as explained by the foreign minister, was so pressing that there would be no time at this late date to look for and make overtures to the right man. And as the means of travelling would be to fly across the Pacific, I thought it would be practically impossible to ask of an aged elder statesman. I decided that there was no one but myself to do it. So I replied, "I'll accept it." Until that evening, Premier Tojo was a total stranger to me. The premier, it seemed, had just made himself comfortable following a busy day at the office, as he was in his kimono and hakama. During the course of discussion with Premier Tojo that night, it was revealed the Prime Minister had the same opinion as the Foreign Minister and myself in recognizing this proposed mission to be an extremely difficult one. But given that, number one, America's preparation for war on both oceans was still insufficient, number two, Americans' public opinion was not supporting war, and number three, Americans' provisions for such important war materials as tin and rubber were insufficient, he believed Americans, willfully, would not look for war. He repeatedly emphasized that I should strive for a compromise, as he believed the possibility for conclusion of the negotiation to be 30% for success and 70% for failure. Furthermore, I still remember him saying that of the three knotty problems of the negotiation, the question of evacuation of troops was one in which no concession should be made, and that if any concession should be made in this matter, he would not be able to face towards Yasukuni Shrine and sleep. Boarded the California Clipper, a considerably larger plane than the one I had been on, and headed for mainland America. I arrived in San Francisco after having slept overnight in the sleeping compartment of the plane. As was expected of mainland America, the number of reporters and others who were there were considerably larger, and I had great trouble in replying to their questions. At 10:30 a.m., November the 17th, accompanied by Ambassador Nomura, I entered the office of the Secretary of State at the Department of State and held my first discussions with Secretary of State Hull. This was not the first time I had met Secretary of State Hull. It was the first time I had met the President. My impression of the President was what a cheerful and broad-minded individual he was, and that he, amidst his affected airs, possessed the appearance as to be expected of one who came from a blue-blooded American family. If I were to look for a similar type among our country's statesmen whom I know, it would be Prince Fumimaro Konoye, adorned with American-like vitality and vigor, or perhaps more accurately, if I were to say a combination of Prince Konoye and Lord Shigenobu Okuma. I explained to the President our government's desire for peace, and sought his understanding of the present frame of mind of our people, who had seen 4 years of the Sino-Japanese incident. I further stated that judging from the military situation I had seen on my way to America, even I, a layman in military matters, could see the situation was very pressing and in such a state as would explode into crisis should one false step be made. I asked, what would Japan and America gain by bringing about such a situation? The President, expressing a similar opinion, promptly replied, yes. What for? I continued and explained that what we should note at this time was the question of time element, and should the negotiation be prolonged any longer, Japan's position would become graver, both economically and militarily, eventually leading to her total submission. In reply to this, the President quoted the famous remark, "There are no last words between friends." He thus made it clear that America had the intention to continue the negotiation to the very end. I suggested that even in regard to the Sino-Japanese peace question, as long as America interferes even in setting terms and manifests such attitude as to support China, it would be very difficult to reach a conciliation between Japan and China. The President replied that he had heard of the difficulty of evacuating the troops because of the Sino-Japanese question, and he stated, "I don't know whether such a word as this is used diplomatically, but how would it be if America were to be the introducer for both Japan and China?" I strove very hard to induce a speedy conclusion of the negotiation by impressing strongly upon America the urgency of the situation, and at the same time was very careful in the usage of my words to avoid giving either party a feeling of intimidation. However, my hope for the future of the negotiation was strengthened because of the statesmanlike attitude of the President, the proposal for a general agreement, and the use of a word such as introducer. However, the reply which we received from our government was a very furious one, almost a reprimand. It read, The pressing situation of today absolutely cannot be saved with merely such a guarantee as to restore the situation to that which existed prior to the freezing of funds. It censured us for having presented our plan without prior arrangements as regrettable in view of the delicate domestic situation, and directed us to submit, without fail, Plan B at our next meeting, stating, so long as America's acceptance of the above cannot be had, it cannot be helped should the negotiation be ruptured. On the 20th of November, Plan B was submitted. The primary reasons why America refused to give her consent to Plan B were as follows. Discontinuation of aid to Chiang Kai-shek is tantamount to discontinuation of aid to Great Britain. America cannot accept it. The transfer of troops in southern French Indochina merely to the north would still keep the troops of other nations in the southwest Pacific area. The statements of important government leaders, as usual, advocate the armed aggrandization policy. There is none such as would give credence to this peaceful intention of Japan. And finally, the fact that Japan's furious request for a reply without consideration of the fact that each of the nations concerned must request their respective government for instructions gave the impression as though it were a demand. Secretary of State Hull's attitude, which had been friendly and cheerful until the conference of the 26th of November, appeared to have changed suddenly. I came to think of it later, but it was because of an important reason. Dispatch number 726 from Togo to Nomura was sent on the day of my departure, the 5th of November. This was one of the reasons for the misunderstanding that I had come to America with the knowledge that a final ultimatum would be submitted. That this message had been intercepted by America has been explained at the beginning of this book. Furthermore, this message had been completely mistranslated, and it appears as if the translation was completed and shown to the Secretary of State on about the 22nd. The message in question was the instruction from Tokyo concerning Plan A, which was one of our final plans. Although the original message had, as its beginning, the phrase, as a final conciliatory plan, America's intercepted message read, as a final revised ultimatum. It is only logical that America, including Secretary of State Hull, became offended upon reading this mistranslation, and reached the conclusion that Japan possessed no sincerity. Our meeting with the President was held on the 27th of November, amidst such an oppressive atmosphere. The previous meeting, that is, the meeting of the 17th, was held in the official reception room of the White House, but this was held in a room appearing to be the office of the President. Of course, the Secretary of State was present. The situation then was not only pressing for me, for according to the literature made public since the end of the war, the President, too, appeared to have been fully cognizant of the seriousness of the situation. In spite of this, the attitude of the President towards us was suave and graceful and cheerful. After we had taken our seats and Ambassador Nomura had accepted a cigarette offered by the President personally lit a match and attempted to light the cigarette. But Ambassador Nomura, having only one good eye, could not bring the point of his cigarette to the light extended by the President. The President laughed and extended his hand further to light the cigarette. Consequently, the meeting was begun ostensibly in an extremely amicable atmosphere. The President then pointed out that Japan and America had suffered together as allies during the last war because Germany was not able to understand the psychology of the other nations. Continuing further, he explained that he was happy to hear that there have been some peace advocates in Japan and that he still had great hopes of Japan and America arriving at a peaceful settlement. In all probability, the President must have been receiving in rapid succession from the American authorities stationed along the coast of French Indochina and China reports of the movement of our land and sea forces, the unloading of various weapons, and the movements of our transports. The situation wherein the negotiation would become much more difficult as the deployment of our strength became known was gradually becoming a reality, just as Foreign Minister Togo had feared at the time of my departure from Tokyo. The President further explained that, as stated by Envoy Kurusu recently, he was fully aware that the frame of mind of the Japanese people, who had suffered 4 years of war, could not be measured by the standard of peaceful America. But the fact that there had been no peaceful statements from the leaders of Japan during the discussions between the Secretary of State and us had made this negotiation very difficult. Finally, the conference ended with Ambassador Nomura, relying on his friendship of 30 years with the President, appealing to him to break the deadlock with his statement. In other words, with this discussion, our effort to make America reconsider and bring about a change in the deadlock ended in a complete failure. The negotiation was now in a practically hopeless situation. The Secretary of State, who had been silent to the newspapers and others concerning the negotiation in the past, voluntarily made a public statement concerning the meeting on the 26th. Responding to this, the newspapers, with such headlines as Hull hands peace plan to Japan and America rejects second Munich plan, emphasized such points of Secretary of State Hull's so-called four basic principles, against which no one could raise an objection, as abstract arguments, and wrote that it was up to Japan whether to accept America's proposal. The Japanese government's dispatch explained that it regarded America's note of the 26th as surprising and regrettable, and instructed us that Japan absolutely cannot consider this note as an overture, and that there was no alternative but to submit to them the imperial government's opinion, to be wired in 2 or 3 days, and in reality, to break off the negotiation. However, just before this, Premier Tojo's American and British expulsion speech was greatly played up in the American newspapers on the 30th of November. Above all, the part claiming that British and American exploitation of the Asiatic races should be exterminated with vengeance was given larger publicity. Since the Prime Minister had clamoured for the expulsion of the opposing country, in which not one but two of these ambassadors were busily engaged in a negotiation, it was not unreasonable for the repercussion it caused within the various quarters of America to have been so strong as to be beyond the imagination of people in Japan. The 1st of December meeting with the Secretary of State was held at the Department of State under such an extremely tense atmosphere. At the very outset, the Secretary of State touched upon the Premier's speech with a grave expression. I explained that I believed the Premier's speech probably had been twisted and exaggerated, stating that if only a certain portion and not the complete text of anyone's speech is given, the real intention of the talker could be misinterpreted into something with an entirely different meaning. Then, the Secretary of State revealed that he was receiving in rapid succession from the American authorities on-the-spot reports concerning the latest deployment of our troops in the Southwest Pacific area. He explained that we would be able to fully understand how America felt today if our positions were reversed and the Japanese Army and Navy were placed in a similar position. As the close of the meeting, I stated that the motto, "Don't sell China down the river," was prevalent in America. But would not Japan and America be selling themselves down the river if they should eventually go to war against each other because of the China question? In reply, the Secretary of State nodded, but only repeated that in view of the present situation, he wanted Japan to open the way for fresh development through the improvement of her speeches. Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells, who had substituted for Secretary of State Hull, who was ill, requested us to call. He handed us a document stating that it was from the direct order of the President. It pertained to the recent strengthening of our troops in the southern French Indochina area. It was a harsh document of warning, announcing beforehand that appropriate actions would be taken in terms of America's national defense, depending on Japan's reply. The document received from the Undersecretary was immediately wired to our government, but our government's reply was very brusque. It stated that the rumor of the strengthening of our troops was considered to be an exaggerated report of the strengthening of our troops in a section of northern French Indochina, initiated primarily for the purpose of preparing against the Chinese troops recently active along the border. As we saw it, when compared with the reports believed to be in the hands of America then, this response would hardly be satisfactory to them. At the same time, the Department of State issued a report that there were 125,000 Japanese troops in French Indochina, and two divisions under the escort of warships appeared to have finally become critical. Consequently, we, who were unaware that the government had held an imperial conference and had already decided on war, were deeply concerned about the situation and requested the government to give us a reply clarifying our peaceful intentions a little more if it desired a settlement of the negotiation. However, our government's reply was that it was impossible to explain any further, since it involved a secret. The 7th of December was Sunday. I heard from Naval Attaché Ichiro Yokoyama, who had called in the morning, that many messages seemed to have been delivered to the embassy office. Then I received a report from Secretary Yuki that the Imperial Government's opinion, mentioned in the government's instructions of the 28th of November, had arrived. Since numerous messages had arrived simultaneously that morning, there appeared to have been considerable confusion in the embassy office and the wireless room. The final message, specifying the time for the handing over of the memorandum, arrived about 10:30 a.m. of the 7th, and since instructions to the effect that typists should not be permitted to type the memorandum for the preservation of its secrecy, a higher-grade secretary who was not adept at typing began typing it from the morning of the 7th. It did not progress as quickly as expected. Ambassador Nomura, too, was considerably worried, and it became evident that the important memorandum would not be ready for 1 p.m., the time arranged with Secretary of State Hull. The appointment was unavoidably put off until 2 p.m. I, together with Ambassador Nomura, went to the State Department. It was 2:20 p.m. when we finally met with the Secretary of State. After looking at the clock in the room and announcing the time to us, the Secretary of State began reading the memorandum, which was handed to him. In the meantime, the excitement gradually caused his hand holding the memorandum to begin shaking. Finally, after having finished reading it, the Secretary of State made the now historically famous remark, "Throughout the 9 months of negotiation, I never did say a lie, and in my 50 years of public service, I have never seen a document so full fabrication and falsehood." After we had heard this, we silently left the Secretary's office. As this was Sunday and the meeting had been arranged suddenly that morning, there were not many people at the Department of State and practically no reporters when we arrived there. When we were about to leave, they began gathering gradually, but we refrained from replying to their inquiries and returned to the embassy. It was then that we heard the news of the attack on Pearl Harbor. As soon as the automobile we were riding entered, the front gate of the embassy was closed, and the police started warding off the crowd, which began to gather. When I entered my room upon returning to the embassy, I saw Finance Officer Tsutomu Nishiyama standing dumbfounded. As he was an expert on finance and economics and had been residing in and studying in America for many years, he knew better than anyone else that Japan absolutely would be no match for America in protracted war. With a feeling that we lacked the one thing we needed, we blankly stared at each other and could think of nothing to say. In the meantime, military attaché Saburo Isoda, with tears in his eyes, came to my room and expressed his sympathies. The other members of the embassy all had a dejected look. I certainly was deeply moved by the varied feeling of sympathy shown by these people toward me, who had failed in an important mission.